Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how Arizona businesses could be affected by this latest round of tariffs.
And the world as seen through the windows of 125 Waffle House restaurants.
But first, Arizona's public school superintendent is worried about the state's chronic absenteeism rate. Research from the Helios Education Foundation earlier this year found the rate at 29% among first through eighth graders during the 2022 to 2023 school year. Chronic absenteeism is defined as missing 10% or more of the school year, or 18 days in a typical 180-day school year. So to try to bring the rate down, Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn is encouraging school districts to enact a policy that would fail a student for 9 unexcused absences. He's also calling for districts and police departments to more strongly enforce truancy laws. I spoke with Horn earlier about this, and we started with what he'd like to see happen as far as bringing in law enforcement to get more students to show up at school.
Sure. The main message wasn't so much law enforcement as it was, I would like other districts to copy the it'll come to me, the district that has policies that have worked very well, which include what I've been advocating for some time, which is to bring back the old method, which is that 9 absences and you don't get credit for the course. And it's a tough, but we need something tough. The reason is that parents have the most influence on the children as to whether they get them to school or not. And I think it was during COVID that they got in the habit that they don't necessarily need to go to school. And so we're seeing it being much more lax. The number of students who are absent 18 days or more before COVID was 9%. Now it's about 30%. So that's become a really serious problem. You cannot teach children that are not there. And parents want their kids to pass their courses. They want them to graduate on time. And I think that's most effective. And this district that we featured.
Dysart, I think, right?
Dysart, yeah. At Dysart, they've instituted that again, and it's been extremely successful for them. You know, we're a local control state, so I can't force it. I'm trying to influence districts to implement policies like that, because when they have lax policies on attendance, and some of them also have lax policies on holding kids back. A couple of teachers came to me to complain that the kids were going from one grade to another without being able to read, and the they really should be held back, but the school board had said they don't like the idea of holding kids back. That's a very, very bad policy. So I'm urging that policy. Now, in addition to that, these teachers that complained to me said that their police officer had turned in to the city attorney cases that should be prosecuted, and the city attorney hadn't gotten to it. And so I'm urging city attorneys to be more, you know, give a higher priority to truancy cases.
So am I understanding you correctly that you are not opposed to, for example, parents facing consequences for their kids not being in school?
I'm totally in favor of it because they have the most influence on the kids getting to school.
I'm wondering if you see any parallels between this kind of policy that you're advocating for in terms of a student failing a class if they miss a certain number of days and the policies that some places have implemented where if kids miss too many days, they're suspended from school. I just wonder if there are any similarities in terms of creating a disincentive for kids to go to school. Like, why bother if I'm just going to fail anyway? Or if I've already failed the class after, you know, a certain number of absences, why bother showing up for the rest of the year? That kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure suspension is the solution because that just makes the kids stay home more. I think the solution is not getting credit, which is what Dysart does. And the reason that is effective for them, and I believe would be effective throughout the state, is because the parents want their kids to graduate on time. If the school just passes kids along, no matter how much they're absent, no matter how little they learn, they don't have the incentive. Parents don't have as much incentive. Many parents do, obviously, but some don't have the incentive to make sure the kids go to school.
So in your mind, like, how would it look in terms of finding truancy cases? Like, do you envision either city police departments or maybe the county sheriffs or maybe even schools hiring truancy officers to go look for parents and kids? Or is it just if they come upon somebody and they realize that that's what it is, then they bring that case forward? Like, how do you envision it working?
Well, some districts do have truancy officers, and that those were the teachers who came to me to complain because the truancy officer did his job, but the city attorneys were taking forever to get to it if they ever did get to it. But the main message on law enforcement is that every police officer has the same powers as a truancy officer has, so they need to be watching out. And when they see a kid hanging out instead of being in school, they need to inquire.
I'd like to ask, if I might, about another issue that I know that you're very involved with, that is the potential elimination of the U.S. Education Department. I know that this is something that you are in favor of. I think the line you use was something about that if they actually do it, you'll throw a party to celebrate the U.S. Education Department going away.
Yeah, actually, the way I describe it, I say, well, if they destroy the federal department, the first thing that'll happen, and people are expecting me to complain or something, I see the first thing that'll happen is I'll throw a party.
Okay. So I'm wondering if, you know, as this talk has started and as some of the work has started, you know, some staffers have been let go and some of the, you know, the work of what the Department of Education, the federal version, is doing has started to be migrated to other places. I'm curious how that's going for your department in terms of, like, just keeping up with some of the changes that are happening in D.C.
Well, we haven't noticed anything, but there's a much bigger issue, and that is we already monitor schools. I have 600 people in here who know a lot about Arizona schools. In Washington, D.C., you have people in an ivory tower. They don't really know what's going on here, but we're monitoring the schools, and they're monitoring us, and that's two agencies doing the same thing that one agency can do. And the big thing in my mind is, first of all, it would be done better by our department because the people here know what's going on in Arizona schools. But secondly, I want to be sure that everything is efficient enough so we can have more money to pay our teachers. We absolutely have to be paying our teachers more. We are now losing more teachers from the profession than are coming into the classroom. If everything could be more efficient, and we would have the benefit of the savings of eliminating that huge department, I would want to put it into increasing teacher salaries.
Do you have any measure of confidence that if the U.S. Education Department goes away, that means more money specifically to Arizona that could be used for teacher salaries?
I don't know. It's a hope, but I don't have, they just haven't come out with enough details to know that. We have brought to their attention that if they are giving the power to the states, it should be to the state superintendents and not to, you know, the governor or some other place, because we have 600 people who do nothing but education. The governor has three or four, the attorney general has none. So we're lobbying for that, but there's no way to predict it until they start coming out with more details.
Okay. I'm wondering if any of your staffers have run into an issue where somebody with whom they work in D.C. on whatever program it is or whatever grant or funding stream or whatever it is, that person has been let go and the person in your office doesn't know to whom they should be reaching out with a question or a concern or anything like that.
If that were to happen, I think I would find out about it, and it hasn't happened to date. Doesn't mean it might not happen in the future, but it has not happened to date.
Is that a concern of yours?
If it happens, it'll depend on the details. So, you know, I'm not sure whether it'll be a significantly negative thing or not until I know exactly what's happening.
All right. That is Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction, Tom Horn. Tom, thanks as always. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
A bill to punish people who claim military service or honors they do not have or did not earn has become one of the more contentious issues this legislative session. It passed the House without any opposition, but is stalled in the state Senate. A compromise may be on the offing, though. With me now, as he is every Monday during the legislative session, to talk about what to expect this week at the state capitol, is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. Are you expecting compromise? Have you met these lawmakers?
Well, you've met more of them than I have, but it sounds like there may actually be a compromise on this so-called stolen valor bill. What's going on with that?
Well, the original bill was introduced to suggest that there are people running for office or doing other things who are claiming military honors, military service they didn't do. Now, there's a little bit of a personal backstory on this, not for me, but for Walt Blackman, who introduced the bill. He was running against a guy named Steve Slayton. And Mr. Slayton had claimed that he had been a combat helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and that there were certain awards and medals that he had earned. Well, it turns out that A, some of those awards and medals didn't exist, and B, his DD-214, which is the military record, shows, in fact, he was a helicopter mechanic in Korea. Hmm. And so Mr. Blackman, who was in the military and did serve in the Middle East, said, you know, this isn't right, and he introduced a bill. As you point out, it got through the House okay. Goes to the Senate, goes to Wendy Rogers' bill. Now, Wendy Rogers was a supporter of Mr. Slayton against Mr. Blackman in the last election.
Right.
And she said, well, you know, it really isn't right, and it's too broad and everything else. And so they're doing a workaround where they're going to use somebody else's bill for what they call a strike everything amendment to come up with something that they think is more acceptable. For example, one of the things that they're taking out is that the original bill said it was a felony to try to get any certain kinds of benefits from misrepresenting military service. And a benefit would include campaign contributions, would include trying to get votes. Well, that is gone. Mm. There were some specific medals that were listed as being verboten, if you will, that would get you into trouble. That specific list is gone. Instead, they've got more of a generic thing in terms of knowingly misrepresenting themselves to be a veteran, knowing misrepresenting certain awards. They also have clarified something that was in the original bill, which is, does somebody who was an elected official who was convicted of this automatically get bounced from office? Rather than put that specifically in the bill, they went ahead and simply referred to the fact that if you're convicted of a felony, you lose your office. I mean, that goes back to what happened to Fife Symington, mm-hmm. Years and years ago. So there's a belief that this may, in fact, get out. I don't know. Obviously, we'll get to see when the bill goes to the floor, whether Ms. Rogers or some of her other allies will try to go ahead and kill it.
Interesting. Howie, there's also a bill dealing with the taser maker company, Axon, which has its headquarters in Scottsdale. There's been a lot of controversy in that city about a proposed development plan that Axon wants to build a new headquarters, some other things, and also specifically housing, specifically multifamily housing that a lot of residents don't want. They got enough signatures to put it on the ballot. Axon has since said maybe they're going to leave Arizona or at least leave Scottsdale because of this. But there seems to be maybe a legislative, I don't want to call it a fix, but maybe an answer to some of this?
Well, I think the term is workaround, you will. As you point out, the residents gathered enough signatures to refer the measure to the ballot. In general, legislative actions, including at the city or the county level, can be referred to the ballot. And under the way the law works, the measure is held up until voters get to vote on it, and that would be November of 2026. Axon figures, look, we've been trying to work on this for years. We have a corporate office here. We want to build some housing for our employees, and we're not willing to work. So they've got this bill, which is, I won't call it special interest legislation, but consider, it affects only municipalities between 200,000 and 500,000 persons. It has to be located within an international headquarters campus, solely owned by a single entity, where you've got more than 2,000 full-time employees, an average annual compensation of 125% of the median income, and then has certain things about restricting the occupancy to former employees and friends and families of employees and things like that. It's an Axon bill. It says essentially it doesn't matter, because what would happen is if you met all that, the city would be required to issue the permits mm-hmm. for the housing, for everything that they want there. making the referendum totally moot. And I think that's really ticked off a lot of people for different reasons. A, you're overriding what folks want. And B, then there's some folks in a particular group who talk about quote unquote 15-minute cities. In other words, you know, trying to build places where people can walk to work. And that has raised a whole bunch of issues of folks who are saying, you know, why are we social engineering and everything? So there's perhaps enough opposition on different corners to kill this. I don't know, however, whether the desire to keep Axon here and, you know, the company, as you point out, that makes tasers, will override all that.
Yeah, Howie, very briefly, about 30 seconds left. I'm curious, you mentioned it ticked off a lot of people. Did it tick off, do you think, enough people at the Capitol to potentially kill this proposal?
Well, I think what they did is, in wording it that it only affects, you know, cities between 200,000 and 500,000, there can be a lot of lawmakers who represent other cities and say, it doesn't affect us. Sure, let's go along with it. I think there's a lot of loss of revenues that they're concerned about there. And it's just, you know, a black eye for the state to lose a corporate headquarters.
Indeed. All right. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, looking through the South's changing landscape from the booths of Waffle House.
And what I found is that in those spaces, everybody's sort of keeping to themselves. But if you open up a conversation with somebody else, that base necessity of saying, I'm at this Waffle House, you're at this Waffle House, therefore we have that in common.
We'll hear from the photographer behind the book, Waffle House Vistas.
But first, it continues to be a bumpy ride on stock markets around the world as countries and businesses deal with the impacts of new tariffs imposed by the Trump administration last week. These new tariffs do not affect either Mexico or Canada, Arizona's two biggest trading partners, although earlier ones do. And all of this got Arizona Republic editorial page editor Elvia Diaz and her colleague Joanna Allhands thinking about how these tariffs may impact the state. Diaz joins me to talk more about this. And Elvia, we've seen the impacts on the stock market over the past few days, but what are some of the effects you and Joanna were thinking about specifically here?
Well, when we were writing initially, we were thinking about Mexico and Canada, because Mexico is Arizona's largest trading partner. And, you know, within a few minutes, we found out, just like the rest of the world, that Mexico and Canada were actually exempt from the new tariffs that President Trump was imposing. However, I mean, there are so many other things that are still going to be affected, because Trump had already placed 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico. That's separate than the ones he announced last week that are not part of the trade agreement. And that includes, you know, cards, imports, and parts. And that's huge for Arizona and Mexico. So we were looking at that. And you and I know that the stock market has been absolutely terrifying since then.
Does it seem as though economists have a sense yet of what those tariffs, the ones that were placed on Canada and Mexico originally, like what the impacts will be? Or is it still maybe too soon to say?
I think it's still too soon, and I had been monitoring what Mexico is saying, and you saw the Mexican president sort of celebrating, and, you know, rightly so. However, again, the automobile industry between Mexico and Canada is huge, and so they said they're going to keep negotiating, but right now that's going to be a huge hit. And also what Joanna and I were looking at, it's how prices are going to go up regardless, right? So what Mexico and Arizona, right, specifically, or the U.S., you know, the products and services that are part of the North America Free Trade Agreement, or that was the old name, but, you know, the trade agreement between the three countries, you know, included agriculture and food, you know, chemicals, clothing, medical devices, and pharmaceuticals, etc. So that is huge. However, even those prices, I have seen that they have gone up in the past few days. You know, I specifically was looking for avocados from Mexico, which obviously are excluded in this new tariff. So if you go to any grocery store, you will see that it has gone up. You know, I was shopping at a local Costco over the weekend, and it was $10.49 for 6 avocados. And I looked to see if they were from Mexico, and sure they were. And that was up from $4.99 less than a year ago. So that's a huge increase without the tariff. So that's why, you know, I was also concerned that companies are just going to jack up prices just because they can.
Well, and Elvie, you mentioned Mexico, of course, Arizona's biggest trading partner. Canada is Arizona's second biggest trading partner. And, you know, these tariffs could impact not only goods that are coming into the U.S. and into Arizona, but also goods that Arizona companies are shipping abroad, right?
Yes, and that's what Joanna, my colleague, was writing about, that although it is great news that, you know, Mexico and Canada was exempt from the new tariffs, I mean, Arizona does business with countries around the world, and we outsource services as well. You know, semiconductor, for instance, you know, we import workers as well, you know, to help us. So, and, you know, she was also concerned about water and some other things. So no, I mean, Arizona is connected to the world, and we're going to see the impact, and we're seeing it now, because trade and economic development is also based on human instinct and human feeling, right? And you have seen the stock market, and I by no means know the market very well, but I know when it's up and down. And if anyone has a 401k or retirement or have any kind of stocks, they know that they're losing a huge amount of money. And that's just not good for the world economy. That's not good for the United States. And everyone who knows about this, it just knows that it's not going to be good in the short term, but it will even be worse in the long run.
Well, President Trump and his administration are acknowledging that there might be some short-term pain here, but are confident that these tariffs will lead to more investment in the U.S., more wealth in the U.S. It sounds like you're not convinced, though.
No, of course not. You know, and every single expert that I had been reading over the weekend and even before, you know, Republican or Democrat, had been saying the same thing. This is just dumb. The Wall Street Journal, which is sort of a conservative voice, you know, has been saying this for weeks now, that this is incredibly dumb, that this could put us into a recession similar to the 1930s. You know, let's hope not, right? I mean, Trump, it just seems to live in the 1950s, and everyone seems to agree on that, this weird notion that we're going to go back to the golden age where we're manufacturing everything ourselves here in the United States. Well, that's good and dandy, but that's not going to happen, not the way that we are interconnected right now. So things are not going to go well anytime soon. And you know what, if the president is so convinced that this is great, as he actually shared this morning, Monday, you know, that don't be weak, don't be stupid, you know, hang in there, remain strong. Well, people are losing their savings, their retirements, you know, things are going up, you know, this is real. So, and now, you know, a few minutes ago, I was reading that some of the president's folks were thinking that maybe he will pause all the tariffs for 90 days. So if he's so sure, he wouldn't be doing and be so stubborn as he is right now.
Interesting. All right. That is Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor for the Arizona Republic. Elvia, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Well, as Mark mentioned a moment ago, global markets are swinging wildly as fallout continues from President Trump's tariff announcement last week. And it can be easy to forget that there are a few other international stories unfolding. Thankfully, the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones joins me now via Skype to remind us about a few of them. Rob, let's begin in Egypt, where French President Emmanuel Macron will be visiting this week. Tell us about the stakes of this trip.
Well, this is interesting. Macron, the French leader, has very good relations with Egypt. France has for a long time. And Egypt is very pivotal to what goes on in the Middle East. There's an old saying that, you know, no deal is ever struck in the Middle East without Egypt being involved in some way or other. So Macron is heading there. He, in a sense, you could say he's filling a power vacuum. America's obviously caught up with all the tariffs issues. Other leaders, like the new German leader, very much caught up with domestic politics. So Macron is really sort of forging ahead on the world stage. And in particular, he's thinking about what's happening in Gaza and what will happen next in Gaza. So he's been meeting with the Egyptian leader today. He'll be meeting with the Jordanian leader today as well. And they will do several things. They will come out and say, let's try and restore the ceasefire between Israel and Gaza, and let's endorse the Arab plan to reconstruct Gaza after the war finally ends there. That plan was put forward a while ago. A number of countries have endorsed it. And effectively, it means leaving the Palestinians in charge in some way in Gaza. And that goes against what Mr. Trump has said, which is to displace the Palestinians in the territory to Egypt and Jordan, and then to create, if you like, a sort of Middle Eastern Riviera in Gaza. So it's a very different plan from the American plan, yes. And it's been promoted. Yeah, absolutely. And it's been promoted very much by Emmanuel Macron in his dealings with Egypt today. So expect to hear quite a lot about Gaza, I think.
Yes, very interesting. Well, elsewhere in European power dynamics, this past weekend, we saw large protests on the streets of Spain. What's going on there, Rob?
Yeah, so this is quite an unusual one. We don't get many protests on the streets of Spain, very big ones, but one report talked of hundreds of thousands of people joining protests across Spain over the weekend against the high cost of housing. Now, people are angry in Spain about soaring rents and a lack of affordable homes. Spain at the moment is Europe's fastest growing economy. And that means that that the demand for homes is very high, but the supply is relatively low. And that's where the problem arises. It's being made worse by a tourism boom. And that has seen many houses, many apartments in Spain turned into holiday rentals. Spanish government, the socialist government in Spain, is trying to boost construction and expand the availability of affordable housing. I'll just give you one example. The city of Barcelona, 9 families were competing to rent each property in that city 5 years ago. That number has risen to 54.
Oh, my goodness. Indeed.
So the rental costs in that time, 5 years, have increased by about 60%. So you can see it, not just Barcelona, but in cities all over Spain. This is a real problem, partly fueled, I should say, by immigration, because they're growing so fast. The economy is growing so fast. It's sucking in people from elsewhere, from outside Spain, to help drive that growth, drive that economy. But of course, those people need places to live. So Spain very much under pressure in terms of this issue about housing. Of course, that will resonate with many other communities and cities all over the world.
Well, let's close today, Rob, in Beijing, but not, at least not directly, with a story about tariffs. This coming weekend, on April 13th, Beijing will play host to a half marathon, that's around 13 miles, that will pit human runners against humanoid robots. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, so if you go to Beijing on Sunday morning, this coming Sunday morning at 7:30 in the morning, and you go to an area which is not very excitingly entitled the Beijing Economic Technological Development Area, it's otherwise known as Beijing E-Town, as kind of shorthand.
Okay.
But if you go there, you'll find 12,000 human runners ready to start that half marathon. But beside them, you'll see 20 Chinese robotic firms who have produced humanoid robots, they call them, essentially, which will run alongside these runners, effectively competing with them. It's quite interesting. If you look at them on YouTube, they look they sort of look a bit human-like. They have to be what's called bipedal, which means they have to have two legs for walking or running. So they sort of resemble humans. They're not allowed wheels. The teams are allowed to swap them during the course, but if they do that, they will face a 10-minute penalty. And these things can be remotely used or they can be autonomous. But effectively, what's happening on the streets of Beijing this coming Sunday is a race between human runners and robots who are pretty quick, or which I should say are pretty quick. So this will be an interesting spectacle. And I imagine we'll see quite a few pictures on our TV screens.
Yes, the E-Town Showdown. All right. Well, that is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones keeping us in the loop about a wide range of stories this morning. Rob, thank you so much as always.
Great stuff. Thanks very much.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Duncan Tonatiuh has pretty much always known he wanted a career in the arts. The Mexico native, though, has not always known he wanted to write and illustrate children's books. Tonatiuh is known for using Mixtec imagery in his work. The Mixtec are an indigenous people from Mesoamerica. Tonatiuh says he aims to put his own spin on this ancient artwork. I spoke with him earlier and asked how he got into writing and illustrating books for children.
Well, to be honest, I sort of fell into it. You know, I was interested in art since I was a kid. I loved comic books and manga. And so by the time I was a teenager, I knew that I wanted to pursue a career in the arts. And I went to design school, I went to art school in New York City, but I always thought I was going to do stuff for adults. You know, maybe I'd be a painter and my paintings would hang in galleries, or photojournalist, or I had different ideas throughout the years. But my last year in college is when I came up with my illustration style. I had to have a senior project, and I ended up doing it about a friend of mine that I met in New York. And he is from Mexico, and I'm from Mexico too. But he is Mixtec, and there's a big Mixtec community in the tri-state area in New York. And so I thought that was really interesting. And so I made this kind of short graphic novel, novella. It's too short to call it a graphic novel, but this kind of like comic book about it. But I got really interested in Mixtec art. They had this very unique way of drawing. So I started drawing in a similar style. And a professor at my university saw my project and she thought that it was really good. She thought that the illustrations were really interesting. And she introduced me to a children's book editor. And he liked my work, but he said, you know, this project you're doing is more for adults. You know, he gave me his card and I wrote this story about these two cousins. And I, you know, revised it and eventually became my first published book. And that's kind of what opened this world of making children's books.
Well, it sounds like it wasn't a terribly difficult transition for you then, from going from thinking that you were going to have paintings hanging in galleries to writing and illustrating kids' books.
No, not at all. And I mean, I'm super happy that I found the medium because, you know, like I said, I get to write and illustrate, which are things that I love. But I think also, like, you know, one thing that I like about kids' books is that I don't think they need to have like a happy ending, but I do think they need to have something like positive, something hopeful in them. And one thing that I really love is that if I'm interested in a topic, I can try and learn as much about it as I can and kind of take all that knowledge and hopefully turn it into an interesting book. So I've made books about the people that painted books in Mesoamerican times, about Posada and his Day of the Dead skeletons, about social justice, about different themes. And so it's been really wonderful. I love it.
Were you exposed to Mixtec imagery growing up in Mexico?
A little bit. I mean, not Mixtec particularly, but definitely like Mesoamerican art. Like I remember, you know, in one of my textbooks when I was like in fourth grade or something, it had on the cover a picture of the Aztec calendar. Mm-hmm. And where I grew up in San Miguel de Allende, there's an artisan's market with different crafts. And sometimes they sold or they still sell these kind of codex-like paintings. But as a kid, I mean, I saw them, but the things that I really liked were, you know, like I said, comic books, manga, anime. And it was until I had moved to the United States that I kind of started missing some things that were around me growing up in Mexico, the food, the music, the different traditions. And that's when I kind of became more interested in the art of Mexico and the culture of Mexico.
Was there something about seeing those that even though it wasn't sort of the dominant imagery and graphics that you were used to growing up, was there something that kind of made you feel at home or maybe felt familiar or comfortable to you?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think, you know, the thing about indigenous art and indigenous culture in Mexico, I think, is just so part of life, you know, like Mexican culture is a mestizo culture, is a mix of indigenous and European. And I think it's kind of everywhere, you know, sometimes more obvious than in other instances. But I think it's just kind of, it does feel familiar when you see it, you know, even if you don't see it all the time, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. So in terms of writing books for children, you mentioned some of the issues that you're able to bring up and some of the artwork you're able to use. Is there something about it that appeals to you in terms of maybe teaching kids about cultures that they don't know about or exposing them to different kinds of artwork that maybe they haven't seen before?
Yes, definitely. I mean, you know, when I started making like my project in college and when I started making books, you know, it was a way for me to connect with kind of my Mexican background, with my Mexican heritage. But then, you know, soon after I started making books, I kind of learned about this need for diversity in children's books, you know, because there's so many different kinds of kids in the United States, but the books that are published don't really reflect that diversity. And I think especially when it comes to Latino children, to Mexican-American children, Mexican children, you know, it's such a large community. There's so many of them in U.S. schools, but so few books where they can kind of see those, that part of themselves in books. So I think for me, it's very important to have those books out there where kids can see themselves and can know that their stories are important, that their culture is important, that that's something kind of unique and special. And also hopefully for other people from other experiences and from other cultures to kind of learn a little about someone different than themselves. So that's something that I'm very interested in doing and something that definitely motivates me while making books.
Have you heard from readers or parents of readers who have had that experience of maybe for the first time, perhaps, seeing a book that is about their culture or seeing themselves represented in a children's book?
Yes, definitely. And one, for example, you know, I'm sometimes invited to visit different elementary schools, and I visited a lot of different schools in different parts of the United States. And, you know, it's interesting to see the reaction from children, but also from teachers, especially from Latino teachers that often say, you know, I wish there were these kinds of books when I was a kid. You know, growing up, there wasn't anything, you know, there weren't any kind of books where I kind of felt represented. And I think with younger kids, you know, they, you know, depending on the book, you know, there's a lot of items, the food, you know, like, for example, there's a book that I did, that one, Dear Primo, the first one. And there's a scene where they're breaking up piñata. So that's, you know, I sometimes when I'm reading the book to kids, I say, oh, you know, I remember when I was a kid, I would break a piñata and we would all sing the song that goes, dale, 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 no pierdas el tino. And all the kids, you know, if they have Mexican family, Latino family, they'll start singing the song, you know. So I think they feel like you can sense a joy, you know, that it's just familiar and that they connect with it.
How do you try to put your own sort of artistic vision on some of this very ancient type artwork?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for listeners, if they haven't had a chance to see the books, you know, the part that is very reminiscent of Mesoamerican art is that, you know, the people that I draw are always in profile, their ears look a little bit like a number three, it's very stylized, their nails are very white and round. So that's the kind of part that looks very, it's very much inspired by Mesoamerican art. But one thing that I do a little differently is that I use a lot of textures. And so hopefully that's an interesting combination of something that feels, you know, kind of reminiscent of this ancient art, but hopefully a little bit more modern and you know, kind of interesting to readers, to viewers nowadays too.
Sure. All right. That is Duncan Tonatiuh, an author and illustrator of books for children. Duncan, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Micah Cash is a conceptual landscape photographer. He's interested in the interaction between landscapes and architecture, how the two prompt conversations and disruptions to social, political, and economic structures. Now, if that sounds a little conceptual, His new book makes those concepts feel immediate. So immediate, in fact, that you can practically taste them. His book is called Waffle House Vistas, and it's a series of images taken through the windows of Waffle House restaurants across the southern U.S. I spoke with Micah recently about this project, and he told me the book is about the stories Waffle House tells about life outside and inside the walls of the restaurant.
In many ways, this book started about a year or two prior to making the photographs, because I was looking for a way to discuss sort of this American style of poverty that many of us in the country feel, where we are, you know, one or two paychecks away from financial ruin.
Yeah.
And also this idea that, from what I've witnessed in my life, is that people in America work very hard, and yet it is so hard to get ahead. And then one day I was on the road coming from some book signings and from making photographs, and I stopped at a Waffle House and I looked out the window and I thought to myself, oh, look at the surrounding architecture and landscape. There were certain businesses like Dollar General's or payday loan establishments. And I thought to myself, that's interesting. It certainly plays upon a stereotype of a Waffle House type person.
Hmm. So the thought was, I've stopped at a Waffle House, presumably because it's an affordable place to eat and ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. And you were noticing kind of for the first time, oh, it's not just that when I stop at a Waffle House, there's food here that's an affordable option. It's also been placed in an environment of other businesses that are geared towards people who might not have that much money to spend on the bare necessities.
That's correct. And so that stereotype was sort of an entry point.
After visiting
125 Waffle Houses in 11 states, mm-hmm. it's a stereotype that's not true. But that was kind of one of the hooks that got me thinking about this project. And when I'm in a space like that artistically, I want to ask those hard questions.
Yeah. This stereotype of a person who eats at a Waffle House, how would you have defined that before you started this project? And were you somebody who had a habit of eating at Waffle Houses?
Yes, absolutely. I think Waffle House has always been one of my favorite road foods, particularly if I need to get up and start driving early in the morning.
Yep.
When I was in high school and college, of course, we have a different relationship with it, where it's a place you can hang out with your friends, particularly late at night, maybe coming home from a concert back when I was able to stay up that late. And the people that you eat with on the inside and the people who work on the inside of that establishment, for the most part, are just salt of the earth people, people that are working very hard for their careers and for their families and their hopes and their dreams. And that is something we all have in common. And what I found is that in those spaces, everybody's sort of keeping to themselves. But if you open up a conversation with somebody else, that base necessity of saying, I'm at this Waffle House, you're at this Waffle House, therefore we have that in common.
Yeah.
And so I would talk to people that I really had nothing in common with outside of what brought us there.
So talk a little bit about your process in doing this. How did you pick the locations that you decided to go to? And when you went into these Waffle Houses, what did you do? Like, did they know you were coming? Did you have to introduce yourself and say why you were there?
No, it's a Waffle House, Sam. You just walk in, sit down, and yeah, I could bring my gear in. And most of the time I could make my photographs and no one would bother me. I wanted to visit stores located in high poverty, median poverty, and low poverty counties in each state, mm-hmm. just to see, is there a difference? And in all honesty, you really can't tell a difference. I had this set of rules, and I would go into a Waffle House, I would find a place to sit wherever was open, mm-hmm. and I would have some type of experience in the mornings. You know, I would have a full breakfast. In the afternoons, I would just have, you know, toast and maybe a side of coffee. And later in the afternoons, just coffee. Mm-hmm. But I would always order something. So I would have that exchange with the server.
Yeah.
And I would look out and make photographs from wherever I was seated. Mm-hmm. And that was the rule. I wouldn't really move around the restaurant all that often. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I would go in and I would make bad photographs. Mm-hmm. And I would just go to the next Waffle House. Occasionally, someone would ask me, you know, why are you photographing the parking lot? And that was usually a nice segue into having, and sometimes multiple hour conversations with somebody.
Tell me about one of those conversations that really sticks in your memory.
There was one individual in Richmond who had escaped a negative family situation in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to talk about it, but he sort of described his journey of waking up one day and saying, I have to get out. And he got in his car and he just drove south and ended up in Richmond. And he couldn't articulate why he ended up in Richmond. That's just where he was. And he said, this is good enough and let me go find a job. And so he was sort of reestablishing his new life and incredibly positive. Anybody who has dealt with a family or, you know, a work or some type of social situation and you need to escape it knows that it can very easily go the other way.
Yeah.
And so he was so full of optimism that he had made the right decision. And this was the first chapter of his new life. And that was beautiful.
Wow.
And another one was in Calvert City, Kentucky, which is the restaurant where I made the key image of the project. And this guy, he was maybe 18, 19, mm-hmm. and had graduated high school, had no other plans. And he was just working at the Waffle House to save up to buy a ring for his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And proposed to her. And he had already kind of made some plans to get some land and apprentice under a farmer in Western Kentucky.
Yeah.
And that was his plan. Working at the Waffle House, I'm going to buy a ring, I'm going to get married, I'm going to become a farmer. And he was so insistent that that's how the world was going to work. Hmm. And I loved that. As somebody who's older that knows that life throws curveballs at you all the time yeah. and that the journey is not quite linear. And I used to be a college professor. And so yeah. you would see that a lot from people of that age, but he was just determined to make it happen.
Yeah. Talk a little bit though, about this idea that it was very much for you conceptually about what was outside the Waffle House as much as what was in it. After all, you know, we've been talking a lot about the personalities of people inside a Waffle House, but the book is called Waffle House Vistas. And the images are very much about the setting of the Waffle House trip. So what was it that you took away from this exposure to, I think you said like 125 of these settings?
I think I took many things away. One I took away is that conceptual art can be accessible. It can be made for everyone if you give them a big enough door mm-hmm. to enter into that space. And I was shocked, like I said earlier, the number of people that wanted to have these conversations with me. And I think that's because I made this conceptual body of work to let people in, not to keep people out.
Well, Micah Cash is a photographer and the artist and author of Waffle House Vistas. Micah, thank you for this conversation.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Dip, 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 dip. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today. That big yellow sign. What we're in all started, Atlanta, GA. From old number one to over 600 to